Now we have the fourth one called the Dragon. We're dropping. It's being sent up by a private company called SpaceX. And they've gone up there three times. And you've got another launch later this year by SpaceX. And eventually later this year, you're going to have a fifth spacecraft that's able to dock with the International Space Station, again on the American side. And that's going to be called Cygnus. Now, out of all of these, there's only one, that could be returned to Earth. All of them burn up in the Pacific Ocean. That's it. Load it up with garbage, and we dump it. The only one that actually brings things back is the American Dragon. Back to you, Dave.
Amazing. A lot of stuff. So if you want to send some further questions to Paul, you send them to the website of spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. Thank you, Paul. Lots of stuff. Let's see if Glenn is still with us, KCQQIQ, because I know Wes would like to have a further discussion of what you thought you saw when you saw that high voltage arc with a great big loud explosion and a guy hollering on the tail end of that YouTube video. KCQQIQ, if you're there. KQLIW in the tech man.
HXWS Glenn, if you want to talk about my new generator, I'll talk about that too.
Sounds like you bought a generator. I think you bought one from Harbor Freight, or was it from either Home Depot or that other guy? I can't think of the name of the night, Lowe's. So, who did you buy your generator from? How many watts did you buy? And you've now got standby power to your house, Paul, WS2N, KQRIW.
Power me. It's very nice. Comes out of Home Depot. And 3,250 watts. It's got a surge. You can go up to 4,050. And tried it out. I ran it a couple of hours so far, on and off. Testing it out, of course. You really should, this is a new one, so you should put a couple of hours on it. They say two to three hours before you put full loads on it, so. Played around, of course. Did an all plugged out test, you might, and actually they call it plugged out testing. Take all the plugs out of the spacecraft, make sure it works. Well, that's what I did. I made believe I had a power failure here. Simulated an emergency test and ran a whole bunch of stuff. Works real good.
Pretty fine, Paul. How long ago did you buy it? How many dollars do they claim? How many gallons per hour it burns? The people who buy the bigger generators can live more in the lap of luxury during a power outage, but you got to worry about whether or not you can get enough gas. My sister, for instance, owns a 5,000-watt generator, but because she was worried about not being able to get gasoline during the 2 weeks that she was outside of power in Warwick, New York, she was only running the generator 2 hours per day. I think 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night, just to run the heat and the refrigerator, to keep the food from spoiling and to keep the house warm. So she was worried about running out of gasoline. So, and as you know, what Dave into APG does is he likes sipping gas at, 1.5 gallons per 24 hours on his much, much smaller generator. So, how many dollars was that one for? WS2N, KQLIW?
Yeah, the gas goes about 0.32, they say. It's about, you look at it, if you're going to go half load, that's standard. When you look up the specs, half load is 15 hours. So it's really 3 hours per gallon. That's the way it works out. It's not cheap, but it's not expensive either. $350, 360. So that's not too bad. I mean, you can get a 5,000-watt generator, same company, I think around 700. But then, you know, you're going to go for more gas. And that was consideration, how many times I heard you on the net talking about how many times you got to go back and forth to the gas station when there's a problem. Yeah, you know, hopefully that the generators get put into these gas stations. That'll work out good. Last time it was a pain in the neck, you couldn't even get gas for your car with the odd and even thing going on, and not easy. It's got two circuits on it. That was a little confusing. I called up for that and we dropped it. It's got two circuit breakers, push button circuit breakers. And you look at the 110 outlets, four 110 outlets. Turns out, after calling up, the directions weren't clear on this, but called up, one on the left, the two on the left is one circuit breaker. The two on the right is another circuit breaker. And then there's also a 220 line that you could run if you wanted to. I won't be doing that. But they advise if you're running the 220, that's going to be a bigger load. Don't run anything on the 110. And it turns out the two circuit breakers then become, the control of the 220 line, you know, the two legs, 110, you know, 110. So that's how they do it. They're just connecting the two 110s together to get your 220, and they're just using the two same circuit breakers. I thought it was pretty good. And it starts right away. Two pulls, off it goes. And it's 7 horsepower, which I'm kind of amazed. We drop it. And I have a 4.25 lawnmower. And, I mean, that thing starts right away. It's like Craftsman. But, you got to pull that pretty good. This thing here, I mean, two little pulls and off it goes. And I got the stabilizing for it, do the whole bit. The gas stabilizer, I figured, let me try that. I don't want to gum anything up in the future, a year or two down the road. And, by the way, this PowerMate, they bought up, it's really a Coleman used generators, and they bought up Coleman. So, it's really like if anybody is familiar with Coleman, all my camping equipment is always Coleman. That's really what it is. Back to you, Dick.
That's real good information, Paul. And $360 for 7 horsepower and 3250 continuous watts, 40,500 surge. That's good. Those generators that we bought right after Hurricane Gloria, even though we bought 500 of them at once, 525 of them, we were charging $525 for each one of them. That was 8 horsepower and 4 kilowatts for $525. Bought in mass, buying 500 at once, three tractor trailer loads filled with generators coming from Wisconsin to Long Island right after Hurricane Gloria. So here you are, let me think, Gloria was 1985. Here we are 28 years later. Lots of inflation in that time, and you're considerably cheaper for just a little bit less horse, a little bit less power output. By my standards, you're doing very well. And 3 hours per gallon is a darn good number. I think you said that it must be a 5 gallon tank if it can run for 15 hours on one filling. Lots of people thought they're going to siphon gasoline out of their automobile. And I'm not quite sure how they do it. It's either some kind of a spring or an anti-siphoning device in the filler tube of our automobiles. tried doing siphoning. We're not able to do it. There's got to be some way of getting around that. If you use a skinny enough tube to go in between the wires of that spring, or to go beyond that proper valve or whatever. I wonder if you've heard about that pole. Has anyone figured out how you can siphon gasoline out of an automobile? If you're willing to spend some time, if you use a smaller diameter piece of tubing, I'm sure there must be a way of siphoning gas out of the automobile. If you're willing to spend, you know, 8 minutes doing it instead of doing it in 30 seconds. In 30 seconds, you're trying to do it if you're stealing somebody else's gas. But if it's your own gas and it takes you 10 minutes to get it out of the tank, that's a good trade-off. I wonder if anybody has found anything about that. I'm going to turn it over to you, Paul, first. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I haven't, but I think it's a good thing. Otherwise, you got people siphoning gas out of your car all the time. You know, especially during a problem like that, they'll be sucking the gas out of your car in the driveway. I don't know, Dick. I don't know how that... I've heard of that problem, but I don't know how to get around it. I want to talk about the DBs. I have a meter. Nice DB meter. And I took some readings on that if you want to do that.
So in other words, how good is the muffler and how loud is the sound? Go ahead, Paul.
I thought it was a very big muffler looking at it at the store. It's not sure I researched a lot of these things before. I mean, for like the last year. I wanted to get a generator for the last couple of years. Actually, probably got the Hurricane Gloria, but never did. Procrastinated for, you know, the next 20 years. The DB rigs, I have a nice meter by Radio Shack. And I was able to measure around 10 feet, 81 dBs. And I'm telling you, it's not loud. You think it sounds loud, but 81, it's, you know, it's like DBs with antennas, the numbers are definitely different. You know, whatever they say in you know, the advertisement, I don't believe. It's relatively low. It's a lot lower than my lawnmower. That lawnmower's not too bad. So really, you know, 81 dBs. The advertisement, they don't tell you how many feet away they are. And if I close the gate, if I go down by the curb, I go all the way down to 50 dBs. Now, 50 dBs, if a car that's relatively quiet goes by me on the street, I hear that. The meter shoots up right up, and I can barely hear that thing from the street. So I think it's very quiet.
Yeah, those dBs are real dBs, Paul, but they're not dBm, not dB with reference to a milliwatt. The dB with reference to the threshold of hearing of a human ear in a quiet room. So you measure the weakest signal at roughly 1 kilohertz that a normal human ear can hear, and that's the so-called zero dB reference point. And so 81 dB is 81 dB louder than the threshold of hearing. I think normal human speech is something like 75 dB. I believe a subway train in New York City is something like 100 dB or 110. If you're on the runway of a military airport alongside of a jet airplane, I think you get up to some really big numbers like 120, which I think is the threshold of pain. So that's where those dBs come from. Now, with reference to siphoning gas out of an automobile, see, going and buying $15 worth of gas, about 5 gallons. You get 15 hours with 5 gallons. So if I had a 5 gallon gas can, one or two of them, and go to a gas station, and put that either in the trunk or the back floor of my car and transport it, I worry about the fact that if you got into an accident and that gasoline container burst in a worst case accident, you're in a heap of trouble. Whereas if the gasoline is being transported by way of the normal gas tank of the automobile, it takes a really bad automobile accident before you burst that particular tank. Let me drop. So therefore, transporting gasoline, 15 or 20 gallons at a time, by the normal tank in your automobile, is a much, much safer approach. But has anyone found out anything about the details of how the anti-siphoning of a modern-day automobile works, where you can't easily siphon the gas out of the tank? I think in some cases it's a fine spring in there, and there's not enough gap in between the coils of the spring to put a normal piece of siphoning tube. Well, if I use a small enough diameter tube, I can do it, if that's what it is. So has anyone found out what is the mechanism for anti-siphoning in an automobile, and is there a way that we can bypass it so we can use it to get gasoline for our generators? Anybody got any words on that? Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the tech now. Somebody must have a owner's manual or a service manual for their automobile, which gives you a cross-sectional picture of the filler tube of the gas tank. And therefore we can see, by way of the diagram, what is the mechanism by which anti-siphoning takes place. There's got to be a way of bypassing it. If I can get gasoline in, there's got to be a way I can get the gasoline back out. And I know the gasoline can go in there at a pretty darn good rate, coming out of the pump of the gas station. Okay, that remains to be something else to be settled downrange. I wish Glenn was available, KCQQIQ. I wanted to have him a further discussion on that YouTube video. Let me give another call to him. KCQQIQ, if you're there. K2LIW in the tech man. Looks like he isn't.
Yeah. Well, what I recall what he said, when you put the disc on the coil, it is like you're building some sort of the end of cap of the tension coil, so the capacitor component. Now you put a magnet on the top of it, and you're building a huge E field. And then when you're building the huge E field, you're actually producing the electricity, so then the charge is accumulating. And when you try to put the rod in it, by the means of static electricity, you have a huge potential of over 100,000 volts just waiting to spark on it and to exhale.
And that's a theory. And is it really correct? Yes, assuming now that solenoid-shaped object is a real strong magnet, and now the magnet is being waved around electronically, not being waved physically. See, if I take a magnet and physically move it by Faraday's equation, Faraday's law, a moving magnetic field induces a voltage in a nearby conductor. So by Faraday's law, if I'm physically moving the magnet, I can generate a voltage. But that magnet is not physically moving. It's only electronically moving. If I electronically move the phase center of a magnet, that does not necessarily obey Faraday's law. That doesn't generate a high voltage. There's got to be more to it. I am guessing that assuming that YouTube video was not pieced together and phonied up in any way, as long as it is really a continuous YouTube video telling you a real event, my guess is that the extra metallic object he put on top of the flat plate of this Tesla coil-like thing, that he added a significant amount of extra capacitance by all the extra mass he put on it. That tuned it closer to resonance, and that resonance, it can generate a much higher voltage. That's my guess. But even so, the magnitude of that spark and the amount that he hollered, and if it really is a Tesla coil running at a RF frequency, where he would have skin effect, and the skin effect would not allow him to feel it. The only way I think he could feel it is that there was simultaneous DC voltage superimposed, and by some means that DC voltage flowed through his body. That's my guess. Did you get any hints when you translated the Russian words? Was there any hint as to what the device was?
Repeater, time out.
Once again, were there any hints on when you translated the Russian words as to what they were doing, what they thought changed, and what they thought happened? I think we've got to look a little bit further because there may be associated YouTube videos that show you other events of that particular situation. In other words, many times a guy will put out 2, 3, or 4 YouTube videos sort of linked together, and we've only found one of them so far. N2XJN, KQRIW.
Yeah, so you see, actually, the best guy for that would be Glenn, but I think John could offer a lot of explanation as he was present when Glenn was giving the explanation. Now, there is another revelation. Glenn says that the voltage was very low. Could be if you won't. John, do you remember that part?
KC2WGB. No, not offhand, Wes. I did not look at the video until after, and Glenn was sort of running the explanation and conversation with you while that was going on. So it would be interesting to have Glenn repeat what he said.
In other words, the voltage was high, but when he was touching the voltage, the current flowing through the body was pretty small one, because this is what I understood, the voltage was low. The whole process, he explained, the bigger plate that is on the top, the higher is the E field on it. But now we have an addition, and that addition is a presence of the toroidal magnet. The video is authentic, it's not a phony one. If you look at the video, on the right-hand side, you have a small computer base, it looks like, power supply. So it's nothing special that is going on over there. But phenomenon is worth the attention, but since we don't have Glenn, unless he's listening right now, I would rather wait for him to say it. Dick, maybe you have any idea.
The dielectric strength of air is pretty well documented at 30,000 volts per centimeter, which turns out to be 76,000 volts per inch. That's a dielectric strength of air. When I first saw him hold a welding rod near the top of that metal plate before he added the magnet, I'm guessing he was drawing an arc of somewhere between an eighth of an inch and a quarter of an inch. If it was a quarter of an inch, at 76,000 volts per inch would be 19 kilovolts. If it was an eighth of an inch, it'd be around 9,500 kilovolts. So somewhere around 8,000 volts are required to draw a gap of an eighth of an inch. And then when he added the magnet, I don't remember how close he got with the welding rod, but it looked like a much, much larger distance, like
a millimeter thick.
What was that again, John?
About 100 millimeters.
Okay, that's 10 centimeters. 10 centimeters is 4.5 inches. So 4.5 inches away, if that was an arc of 4.5 inches, that would be 76 times 4.5. That would take 340 kilovolts. Where in the world did 340 kilovolts come from? If he arced through 100 millimeters, 10 centimeters of air, 4.5 inches, it takes 340 kilovolts to do that. So did that device, that Tesla coil-like device, which maybe was out of resonance and only making, we'll say, 8 kilovolts before he added the magnet brought it into resonance, could resonate repeater time out. The next question is, could bringing it into resonance bring 8 kilovolts up to 340 kilovolts? Boy, that sounds like a lot. And even if he brought it into resonance and had the much higher AC voltage, the AC voltage with the skin effect, 340 kilovolts, I touched that myself with our WebSARS machine. As long as there isn't a whole lot of capacitance backing it up, it's uncomfortable, but it's not going to make you scream and holler, and it's not going to give you a great big loud bang like that. You can only get a loud bang like that if you're discharging a whole lot of microfarads and a whole lot of voltage. I remember when I used to take my 20 microfarad oil-filled capacitor, power supply, raise it up to 1,000 volts, and put a screwdriver directly across that 20 microfarad oil-filled capacitor. I would hear a sound exactly that loud, and a small chunk of the tip of my screwdriver would be vaporized. So rapidly discharging 1,000 volts, 20 microfarads, can give you a sound like that. But if I did that to a human being, I don't think he would survive. So the sound being that loud, the gap being that large, and the human being, although being made very uncomfortable, he survived, there's a lot of questions here. You see where I'm getting away on this one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, for the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Dick, there's one thing I'm not sure of. I don't remember seeing the arc or the flash of the arc. I remember hearing it, and that's why it sounded like a DC discharge to me. But I don't remember seeing the flash. Did Wesley or you see it?
Yeah, there's an explanation for that, John. I've seen many of these movies where an arcing of, say, for instance, a web search machine is taking place. And you hear the sound of every one of the arcs, but the picture only shows you every fourth arc. And the reason for that is quite often the picture that you're seeing is quite compressed. You're not looking at every single frame. So even the arc, which only takes a microsecond, either it took place in between one of the frames, or because they're only displaying every fourth or fifth frame, there's gaps in the time domain on the video. So the video gaps would allow you to not see the arc even though you hear it. You always hear it because the sound will echo in the room for many milliseconds. That's long compared to the recording time interval. But if you've ever seen any of those YouTube videos of a WebSARS machine arcing, a lot of the arcs you don't see visually. I wonder if you've seen that effect, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Yeah, Dick, I believe you're right. That's possible. But not to see the reflection of the flash or anything anywhere, I don't know. But that was just one point I wanted to bring up. But you may be 100% right there, because I noticed if I electronically tried to record my Wimhurst machine operating, no, you missed the flash. You're absolutely right there. And I have a 4-inch arc on my Wimhurst machine. But with photographic film, you know, you never miss the arc. So, yeah, you got something going there.
Wow. Your Wimhurst machine is better than mine. My all-time record arc, with very carefully tuning the machine on a dry day and setting the probes just right, was 3 5/8 inches. It's the best I've ever gotten, 3 5/8 inches. You've gotten really 4 inches? Oh, you're just rounding off the numbers. It's number one. And second of all, even if the arc was bright as all hell, even though it's reflecting off of every wall in the room, if the arc itself takes a few microseconds, and all of that light reflecting off the room is going to be the exact same few microseconds. So the fact that it's reflecting off the room, as far as the light is concerned, that doesn't extend the time. Sound, yes. Sound bouncing off the walls at only 1,000 feet per second, that's going to persist with bouncing and echoing and everything else. The sound is going to persist for a whole lot of milliseconds. But the arc is only approximately a microsecond, and the optical portion of the arc is the exact same microsecond. So the fact that you didn't see it bounce off the walls light-wise, it doesn't surprise me, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, you're absolutely right, Dick. It could have happened. If it happened dead center, sure. But if it was on the cusp of the exchange, you may have seen the flash and not the arc. But yeah, it could be either way. Yeah. It was a very loud arc and definitely sounded like DC to me. I mean, I've heard arcs for many, many years, and that was definitely a DC arc. So it's interesting. Whether that was a magnet on top, I don't know. Did Wes confirm that with the interpretation?
Correct, it was a magnet on top.
How do you know it was a magnet? They say that in Russian, Wes?
He said as he was washing the kiosk or shawl, when the magnet is still on the floor, he put his rod, or whatever the metal stick you want to call it, which is the welding electrode, into it, and he showed that it holds it.
Now that's a little bit amazing, because if we check with Paul, I suspect most welding rods are made out of copper-bearing materials, brass, bronze. I think very few welding rods are steel and magnetic materials, but let's see what Paul's going to say on that. Are any of those welding rods... Well, I guess if you were welding steel, it would be a steel rod, wouldn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
One second, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, we'll wait, Wes, go ahead. I mean, Glenn. Here we go, Paul. If I was welding steel, I guess the rod I was using would be a steel-bearing material with flax or whatever wrapped around it. So the fact that he had magnetic properties of the welding rod, at first I thought the welding rod would be, for brazing would be brass. But if he was doing steel welding, then I guess it could be a steel-bearing welding rod. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, yeah, Dick. Let me see if I have it here.
Oh, you sound good. Go ahead.
Very good. If you're welding any kind of steel, carbon, steel, or stainless steel, you're going to use base metal, whatever it is. It's stainless steel. The rod's going to be made of stainless steel. If it's carbon, it's going to be regular carbon steel. That's what it's going to be. You're going to have a flux around it, and that flux burns off, and as it's burning, it's burning the oxygen away, and that's how you prevent porosity to the joint. And I didn't see the video. I mean, this guy might have a heliox setup. He might be holding a thoriated tungsten rod in his hand. I haven't seen that. You know, maybe that's what he's got in his hand, or maybe it's a tungsten rod with zirconium, 2% zirconium. That would be a rod used for aluminum welding. So, whatever the base metal is, that's it. I haven't played around with heliox, and I wanted to, just for fun, weld two pieces of copper together, which I did, and I put a base, put a filler rod. I just used a copper wire. Worked real good. Back to you, Dick.
And Dick, don't forget, that was just a rod. I don't believe there was a wire or any elements attached to it.
That's correct. It was only the rod. Nothing was attached, and the rod looked like it didn't have anything on it, so there was no powder on it embedded to it. So, if you look at the video, it's probably 1 minute and 45 seconds. You see that he has on the floor that magnet, and he put a rod into it. So it does have a ferromagnetic property.
With what you just told us, Paul, where you've got rods of various thicknesses, various materials, various alloys, various rosins or various substances taped on the outside of the rod, I'm slowly getting the impression there's a lot of rods. If I added up all the kinds of welding rods there are, do you think there might be as many as 500 of them? If I looked at all of the materials, all of the alloys, and all of the fluxes on the rods, there must be thousands, tens and hundreds of kinds of rods. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, there's a lot. In the standard steel or arc welding, you've got your basic rod, which is E6010, and that's just a steel rod with flux on it. Now you've got 532 rod, and then you've got the next size up, 1/8 rod, and then you get the smallest rod, 332, 1/8, and 532, and then there's bigger rods, 1/4 inch rods. Then you've got cutting rods, and you run nitrogen down the center of these huge rods, cut steel under the water. You've got submerged rock welding. Now you got all your different materials, aluminum, titanium. You have to fill that titanium with the titanium filler rod. You've got MIG welding, all the different reels, countless different materials for that. Then you go into your brazing department, how many different types of brazing, soldering, it just goes on and on. Carbon arc welding, just a carbon rod, weld some galvanized together. It's endless thing.
Wow. In your experience, Paul, how many of those have you used? And how do you know when you're choosing the right one at the right time? Or you call?
I guess, I don't know, maybe if you want to consider different sizes, maybe 20 different types, I guess. Well, you got to find the one that matches aluminum. You got your, 6010, that's your standard aluminum. You got to use the same part for that. Stainless steel, 708, that's a common stainless steel rod. Carbon moly, that's a special rod for different purposes. I don't know, and of course your different diameters. You're going to fill a big joint, you need a bigger rod, more heat, more amperage. Heliarc, that's another world. You're dealing with a different... You don't want to burn up the rod that you're using for heliarc. You just want to heat the joint, and you want to use a filler rod. Whatever base material you're using. So, I don't know. 15, 20 different types of soldering, of course. You've got brazing, silver soldering. I still have rod here, 15% silver in it, for silver soldering, called sulfos. I mean, there's books on this that are 2 inches thick there.
Yes, if it says we have a few minutes, if you have a time, I could go to a time crystal, because I'm trying to keep up with it for the 3 weeks already.
Now, one last question for Paul. Paul, when I weld stainless steel, at the place where I do the welding, is it still stainless in that area, or do I have to do some additional passivation to restore the stainless property? Over to you, Paul.
Well, I've done pipe, so to give you an idea, you want to keep that stainless. The last thing you want to do is run a weave. Your two basic movements in welding is stringers, that means just straight beads, and then weaves, left, right, and you could have a very wide weave of maybe a half inch, 3/4, or even an inch or inch and a half wide. You can go back and forth, left to the right. They call it a weave. You don't want to do that with stainless steel because you don't lose your stainless steel properties. In fact, if you do that and you put a magnet there, it will be slightly magnetized. So you want to do stringers, go all the way around the merry-go-round each time.
Well, obviously that's an art form. There's a big learning curve there. And lots of risk involved, too, of eye damage if you're not using the right safety equipment. That's the last question. Sorry about that. When it comes to people injuring themselves with welding, obviously not using the right eye protection, you can certainly damage your eyes. You can sunburn your face, your arms, and I imagine touching the wrong thing at the wrong time, you can experience electrical shocks. So give us a couple of words on the dangers of welding if you're a foolish person not following all the safety rules. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I've gone through it all. Shocks, countless shocks. I've got the flash where you at night, all of a sudden you can't see anything. I mean, you look at a 100 watt light bulb, and it looks like it's, you know, it looks like an LED. It's really bad. You can't even open up your eyes. It's terrible. When you start out, you make mistakes. That's what happens. Shocks are a big thing. You know, working in a wet environment, hands are damp. You got welding gloves on. It still goes right through you. A 24 volt will make you feel like you have a heart attack there.
Now, that flash that made you not be able to see a 100-watt light bulb almost, was that because somebody struck an arc and you hadn't pulled the hood down yet? Is one of those questions. And, do people who do welding have a higher probability of cataract operation requirement? Over to you, Paul.
I have cataracts. Pretty bad, but according to my eye doctor, it's not caused from that. So, I think I have a disagreement with them. But, I've gone to two different doctors, and they both agree. You know, you're going to get it when you get older, if you're susceptible to it, whether you're a welder or not. So the story goes from professional eye doctors. The flash itself occurs mainly when you're learning and you don't get that shield down fast enough, or you move your hand and your shield is up and you weren't ready for it and that flash goes off. That'll do it. And the other popular reason, the most popular reason, is you're working with somebody else and you're facing the other direction and you're trying to hold something as they're tacking it together, and you don't physically close your eyes fast enough, you can wind up with that flash. Also, just standing in a room, and a lot of people don't realize, let me drop it. It's important if somebody's welding, you look the other way and you say, well, I'm looking the other way, I'm okay. And meanwhile, there's nothing but ductwork over there. That light is reflecting back off that ductwork, and you can get a flash, no problem. So maybe, probably four or five times in my life I've gotten that. No bargain. It's not good. I've got more shocks than flashes. Let me put it that way.
Question for Paul?
Yeah, John, you've had cataracts. You work with people that do welding, John. Do you see any evidence that people who do welding have a higher probability of cataracts? That's you, John, for both reasons, K2RW.
Well, I don't know about cataracts, but I've done welding myself, and I wound up with cataracts. I don't think it was from the welding. My doctor said no, just like Paul. But there's another thing called pterygium. I don't know. Have you noticed any welders that have complained of that? They're like warts sort of on the eyeball itself, and it's called pterygium. Have you ever heard of that? Dick, back to you.
Go ahead, Paul.
Not at all, John. I'll have to look that up, but not at all.
You've seen evidence of something called pterygium, John? In other words, people who do welding get warts on the surface of their eye, like the white of the eye. Over to you, Paul, John.
Yes, and they're difficult to deal with. And also, sailors who are exposed to the UV constantly, and fishermen, they're prone to get them also. And the word pterygium means winged horse, like Pegasus. I don't know how it comes to be, but that's what it's called.
How does it spell, John?
A problem from galvanized waste, welding there.
Yeah, I'm going to get you a galvanized in a minute. How's pterygium spelled, John?
I think it's T-E-R-I-G-H-A-M, I think. I'm not positive.
And I think, Paul, you're going to tell us that if in a closed environment you're welding galvanized steel and the zinc is being vaporized, I'm led to believe that that gives you an extremely toxic substance that when it gets into your lungs can do all kinds of damage. But if you're doing welding of galvanized material, you better be in an extremely well-ventilated area. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
known probably since the 1950s, but you could be in an environment where you're doing galvanized. I have, and we're aware of it. So, you proper ventilation and this and that prevents it. So I never got it, but the old time, my father was a welder his whole life. That was it. I mean, maybe I was half and half. I was not every day of my life was I welding, but he was. And back in the shipyards and all, and the guys, then that's what, the 1940s, and they used to drink, actually the late 1930s, they used to drink tons of milk to try to prevent that problem. I mean, they were down in the bowels of the ship with all these fumes and everything all over. So it's quite hazardous.
When a person is exposed to galvanized welding fumes and they become very sick, what is it called? Is that a permanent damage? What actually happened? Did you happen to know, Paul? Go ahead.
I know you get very pale, but you can get sick. Now, I don't know about permanent. I don't know. But to avoid it, they call it lead poisoning. I don't know if that's proper name. In reality, I don't know if there's lead involved, but the zinc poisoning that people would get would be pretty bad. But I mean, back then they just, men didn't go off to the doctors, they had their own ways of doing things. They drink quarts of milk, and that, for some reason, counteracted the problem. But they would be in this environment day after day. Never affected him. He lived through an older life, so did all right. Not too good with hearing. I think he got too much slag in his ears.
Dick, could we go to Professor Virchik?
Yes, we can. And I'm guessing some of the welding sounds are so loud that it can do hearing damage. Go ahead with your next subject, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Slag in your ears. Fox, Dick.
Understand. Go ahead, Wes.
There are 9 minutes left, so I'm going to try to wrap it up. Professor Wojciech is a Polish native American, and he got the Nobel Prize. He introduced the time crystal. So shortly, showing the space time crystal that operates in four dimensions. So we have three dimensions, but the additional dimension is the time. So it extends the crystal to four dimensions. It was proposed by Frank Wojciech in 2012, and he says that it operates on the group of particles that move and periodically return to original state, supposedly moving in a circle or form of the time crystal. In other words, he states that over unity, actually it's not over unity, a zero point energy, which would then be perpetual motion, is the level he proposed, that is the year he even proposed the technological approach to build the time crystal. He also states that that might be a shift from the perpetual motion state in the time, the crystal, either way. So towards over unity or down, which would then be less than unity. The process should be understood as the situation at lower energy stage, that the system should be some kind of frozen in space, therefore the system moves and it must break the time symmetry. The equivalent to that total idea, the lowest energy state has the minimal value on the curve on space rather than single isolated point. In the video that I have sent to you, he gives the whole physical and mathematical explanation to that phenomenon, and he presents that in England. And guess what? The same as European University. So, that's about Professor Wojciech. And check on a small thing, just small information. Remember that with some time ago, and I said that I might be able to, if I invite you to my house to see the device that is working with on any matter. It might be possible. Paul said about two the cosmonauts or the space astronauts from Kazakhstan. Actually, there are two gentlemen in Kazakhstan. The space device similar to TK. It works without any batteries. Shows that I had contact with both of them, and possibly I would be able to present it. And so is it.
In the case of the space-time crystal in four dimensions, and the proposal that he made, the presentation that he made, has he made an object out of it? Has he made a test apparatus that does something like a above unity, or generates power without a battery for a certain length of time? What has happened with that that is useful? Is he proposing to come out with a product that people could use? Back to you, Wes, KTYIW.
Actually, John was able to see that video. He would be able to tell you more because he's more fluent. And so, Jim.
You got it, John.
Well, Dick, I have to leave it up to Wes. I watched about 5 minutes of that guy, and I just didn't care for the subject.
But the problem is that you're going to watch this video, and it's going to say, what the heck? I mean, just to get into this, you're going to go through all everything that might be new to you, at least to the certain point. But then you get the idea, and then you would be able to understand it. He proposed that the commercial approach could be made to it, and he got approval of the various number of scientists to this idea as the as the workable one.
But what can be done with the device, Wesley?
Talking about the time crystal?
Yes.
Professor Vilcek is a very much cautious man with speculating. But there is a speculation at the end of the video. There is a speculation. One of the forms of the speculation is statement that the energy may shift to up and down. But my understanding is that we are already in perpetual motion, which he says, and he proves, is here, then we go to the over unity. Or under unity, which would be nothing special, only the coefficients of performance would be high. And so it's it.
I wonder, Wes, how long has this phenomenon been studied? Has anyone yet come out with a demonstration that shows benefit? And was there enough information revealed in those demonstrations where a person could say, okay, I've seen 100 watts go into this apparatus for the last 10 minutes, and I've seen 150 watts come out of it for some length of time, and there's no energy storage devices involved. So has anything useful come out of it yet, or is anyone proposing that in the next year there'll be something useful that can be demonstrated with enough explanation? The fact that a person produces a YouTube video that appears to have 2 kilowatts of light bulbs coming out of it, and the only energy going in was a 9-volt transistorized radio battery, without any more...
battery at all. You don't want the battery.
Understand. And that, of course, is very difficult to explain. And where so little information is given, and no one else that we know of has duplicated it, it's hard to know, is it real?
For you, yes.
And, okay, you've seen one of those in operation. One of them. Is that the only one that exists over the U.S. and 2XJN, K2RIW?
As far as I know, there are these six, seven people who claim to have it. I've seen so far one on my own eyes, and I have a confirmation of at least two of them at different locations. If I contact with the people, then I have a confirmation from a group of other people that I'm associated with that visit already the guy. It works similar way to DK. You have the initial inputs, but there is a more explanation. There is a Russian satellite. So the Russian satellite is very much similar to the Coleman that I'm working on. And at the end, actually, we might say that it doesn't matter what is the shape of the satellite, as long as we would be able, which I own us, Ida, and a few others. There is another scientist also who is with us. The guy is absolutely genius. The state, nuclear magnetic resonance and nuclear spin applied to it, and transportation, that there are two factors that could be blamed for the energy production. Side effects that are associated with the internship.
Is that the time crystal he's talking about, Dick?
No, I'm talking about right now the...
Yeah, we're being cut off. Is TK proposing that the, this will... Is TK proposing that this is going to become a commercial crop and the rest of the world is going to benefit from this? Yeah, I'm kind of curious as to when this is going to become a commercial product sometime in the future. Okay, if you guys are still with us, which bird was TechNet number 1451 of the series, bye-bye for now. We'll see you guys next week. Well, it's John, Paul, and I. These old guys, all the same age. As long as we stay healthy, we'll be back next week. Over to you, John, for any other comments. K2WGV, K2RIW.
I don't know if you can hear me, Dick. I'm trying to come through the Easter line. But, yeah, good net, and a lot of interesting information. And we'll all be back next week. Well, God willing. And we'll have some more fun. AC2WGB.
And I hope you guys now realize that there are ways that you can do a much, much better job of tuning your dipole without changing great big elaborate facilities. But he, and not fully understood, a dipole is, every dipole can be a perfect impedance match with very minor tuning characteristics once you realize how. Bye-bye, you all. Get your eyes pretty clear.
Good night, Dick.
Good night from your friends in Canada, the E3ZCZ.
Bye-bye, Scott. By the way, Scott, have you heard about the correct way of getting a perfect impedance match to a dipole? Over the last couple of weeks when we've been discussing that, was some of that slightly new information to you, Scott? CLIW?
Well, I missed the first half of TonightNet because we were doing some interesting work with the HSMM mesh software, the guys out of Texas. But I did catch last week's, yes.
Okay, so you did find out that there is a way of tuning a dipole to get a pretty good match with whatever means you're using for feeding it. You don't have to make great big changes to those that are feeding. The way you can use a tuning tool held near the tip of the dipole and take the tip of the dipole, whether it's made out of tape or made out of wire, literally fold it back. And as you slowly fold it, 30 degree, 60 degree, 90 degree, 120 degree, and 180 degree angle, you're continuously changing the electrical length of the dipole, and therefore its resonant frequency. And then by putting...